But what I propose to do, I'm going to start by saying a little bit about the history of political parties in the United Kingdom. I'm not actually a very strong subscriber to the view that the biggest problem we have in our political system is the political parties. I don't think that's true. I think there are much, much bigger issues, and I'm going to touch upon them in the course of my remarks. The second part, after the brief historical part, will be specifically about the last election, because it is the strangest general election that in 50 years in politics I've ever seen, and we have to discover how it happened. And so I'm going to talk for a bit about some of the causes of this extraordinary general election and the legacy that it leaves behind it. And finally, for the last part of the lecture, I want to talk about the challenges of the future, not of today, not even of yesterday, but of tomorrow. I believe them to be extraordinarily powerful. They relate to the political system not just in the United Kingdom, but in the European Union, and indeed in the world itself. And the ways in which we can address those problems, which are far greater than almost anything discussed at the general election and almost anything being discussed in Parliament at the present time. They are actually, in some ways, frightening, they are so big. But I hope that many of you here will be part of the generation that has to try to come to terms with it and to understand it. You are going to be very helpful to me in giving your own opinions about them, and I hope you'll feel absolutely free to do so, including telling me, if you like, that I'm a creature of the past, a kind of ancient mariner, and that therefore I should be listening to you, which is fine, I'm happy to do that. Just be nice if you said rather more than you do, other than just, you know, saying, I don't want much more to do with it. Well, let's begin at the beginning then. Parties are essentially, and I think that in his introduction to this lecture, my chairman made mention of this. Parties are essentially a bringing together of people with the same values or similar values, with similar objectives about what they want the nation or the local authority, in some cases, a smaller microcosm of politics, to address. Often very passionate about certain aspects of our social life that they believe they ought to subscribe to trying to get changed or to get altered or to get advanced. So political parties, essentially serious political parties, I'm talking about democracies, are about common values and common objectives. I have to say I'm talking about democracies because in one party states or in states that are driven by one big man, it's really rather irrelevant what the common values or the common objectives are. He, or mostly he, occasionally she, simply overrides the differences and the controversies and compels people to subscribe to or follow political values and political objectives that they don't actually share. Some of you in this audience will have lived in a society of that kind. You'll know what it means. And so have I. I've lived in countries like Argentina, like countries like Brazil, like countries like India, like China, and so I can see the scale of the difference. I still remember to this day the feeling of extraordinary elation I felt when I got out of the plane in New Delhi, having come from Beijing, and heard people arguing like mad with one another in a way that Indians are particularly good at. So I was delighted with them. I felt, here I am, breathing the air, albeit the somewhat polluted air of freedom, and it's a very nice thing to experience. So let me begin at the beginning. In the United Kingdom, where parties were created primarily at the beginning of the 18th century, really after the Napoleonic Age, ending, of course, only yesterday in Waterloo, the anniversary which we celebrated the day before yesterday. There was a strong sense that the elite, the intellectual and social elite, were not consensual. They didn't share exactly the same views. The two major parties at that time, and in the United Kingdom, it always seems to have been two major parties. This is the first time it's really broken down. One of them were, of course, the Conservatives. One could say it always is. And the other were the Whigs, who later became the grandfathers and grandmothers of the Liberals. There was always in the UK, through the 18th and 19th centuries alike, and even into the 20th century, a division of that kind. And that division was fed in many ways by values. Let me just give you an example of two of them. The Corn Laws, which were in their own day revolutionary, the decision to allow trade imports in corn and in other kinds of grain, mainly from the new empire of Canada, United States and Australia, were at the very centre of a belief in free trade. That was a weak belief. The Whigs, or you might now say the old liberals, passionately believed in a world of free trade, of open barriers and borders, one in which there was a regular and huge interchange of goods and services, mostly, of course, at that time of goods, and that was a characteristic that they carried on all the way through the 18th and 19th centuries, even to the point of something very close to breakdown, because the Corn Laws were able, it was such a huge issue. They were, of course, laws to protect British farming, which was more expensive, from imported grain. And so what you got was a very strong division of values and of culture, and for that matter of economic perceptions, between the Conservatives, most of them landowners, or many of them landowners, and the Whigs, who were mostly, some of them also landowners, but often much more engaged in international trade and things of that kind. So you've got this pattern which slowly changed. Why did it change? It changed for the obvious reason. Not that politicians suddenly attracted large numbers of voters from one side to the other. It changed primarily because of major social advances. The first and most significant of those major social advances was, of course, the second round of the Industrial Revolution. And in that Industrial Revolution, there were two new forces who entered politics. One was the force of people who were industrialists, big businessmen, if you like, in those days, as against those who were mostly domestically based on their own farms and land, who were distrustful of trade and of the people that were the great figures in trade, and who were in many ways protectionist for that very reason. Echoes, you might say, of UKIP right up to the present time. Because Britain is a very historical country, and so you can hear echoes from centuries back. Although people think that they're creating something relatively new, they may be. But time after time, it harks back, as it does in a country like China or India, into the history of the past. The second thing to say, therefore, about the development of political parties, came out of a further change in the structure of the economy and the trade pattern of the United Kingdom. And that was the gradual replacement towards the end of the 20th century, sorry, the end of the 19th century and the beginning of the 20th century, of what had been the Whigs by an increasingly powerful new party, the Labour Party, founded at the beginning of the 20th century, in a period just before the First World War, made up primarily and most significantly of workers from organised industry, many of them members of trade unions. The trade unions were the father of the Labour Party. First of all, incidentally, of course, there was a period of about a decade where essentially what there was a group called the Lib Labs. These were liberals, Whigs, who were associated with the Labour Party, but essentially saw the Labour Party as a class element bringing in a new group of people into the franchise, house-owning or property-owning industrial workers. Later the property was mostly dropped, and you got people who were male, white, industrial workers. So it was still in some ways quite a selective sort of party, but it had widened out to cover a whole new class, the class of organised industrial workers. And that remained the most powerful aspect of the Labour Party, as it was called even then, right up until the period after the Second World War. So all the way through the period of the 20s and 30s, including the Great Depression of the 1930s, not just the British Depression, one that was, as you mostly know, at least the Western worldwide, some effect on countries beyond the West. But all through that period, despite it being a hard time, and one that was widening the income and wealth gaps in the country, the Labour Party continued to grow and became the voice of the centre-left over the whole of politics, gradually diminishing the strength and influence of the Whigs, or one might now say the Liberals. They were still on the whole centre-left, but they were on the whole also not part of organised industry. Many of them were in the professions, quite a lot of them were academics, they were, in a sense, a slightly intellectually remote party, but still one which had common values, going back to where I began, and common objectives. Those parties then morphed at the end of the Second World War in two ways. One, both the Conservatives and the Labour Party had an appeal which went well beyond the founding classes, the ones I talked about, the property-owning classes of the Conservative Party, or landowners, and the industrial working class for the Labour Party. The growth of the middle class, a huge growth, which incidentally, even today, you can see paralleled in countries like China and India, the rapid development of the middle class, and therefore with that, challenges to organise politics which they hadn't seen before, because suddenly a whole new class was brought into politics with its own quite specific adventures and, objectives and values. And still, I think it's fair to say, though maybe colleagues here from China or India will comment on this if they'd like to, you still have fundamentally a very serious political problem of how you deal with a rising and fast-growing middle class, which significantly often is individualistic and doesn't live easily with either organised trade unionism or organised business. And that's what you're looking at the moment, not so much in the Western world, but in the Eastern world, where particularly countries like both India and China are now confronting very serious problems arising from the growth of the middle class. In the Western world, the middle class began to move away from, as I've said, the organised economic structures, and there was much more fluidity in politics. And out of that fluidity slowly grew a new group of people who didn't think of themselves either in this country, Conservative or Labour. Sometimes they call themselves one country Conservatives, which already meant they were on the left wing of the traditional Conservative Party. Sometimes they call themselves intellectuals and to some extent allow themselves to abdicate from political parties. In some cases, they saw themselves as being about to form a new party which would reflect their changing values and objectives. That's the conclusion of part one. But let me just say now that we're in part two, which is the current situation leading up to an analysis of the general election. The current situation is one which is, for in British terms, extraordinarily unfamiliar. My chairman referred to the fact that in many countries, coalition is common. It's a way in which democracy works. It knits together different parties who can just about bear to live with one another. Sometimes they find it very hard, in order to form a government. Because in a democracy, what is quite clear is you cannot form a government unless you have political parties who are part of forming it. That's why political parties are essential. They may be not fit for purpose, but they are bound to survive because you wouldn't have a democracy without them. So the question then becomes, what is the shift that takes you from a two-party system, totally dominated in this country for over a century by Conservative and Labour, to a situation now where we are living in a multi-party society? Well, what are the new parties that have emerged? I was part of one of them, the Liberal Democrats, who wasn't entirely new. Part of it was new. Part of it was what was left of the old liberal tradition. Strong commitment, for example, to civil liberties, strong commitment to individualism, strong opposition to racism and other forms of selectivity, and a strong commitment to education. The liberals, the old liberals, had almost phased out by the 1970s. There were only about six liberal MPs, I don't mean just once after an election, but election after election after election. They used to joke that they could be gotten to one telephone box or a taxi, the whole party, the whole parliamentary party. The strange thing was, and you wouldn't have seen that if you hadn't been involved in politics on a daily basis as I've been, the extent to which the old liberal tradition hung on, particularly in parts of the country which had been strongly Methodist in the past, because the Methodists were a people's part of church. They were rejecting of the ancient established religions, and they tended to be people with a very strong social conscience. All over, for example, the north of England, if you go to Yorkshire, places like that, Lancashire, you will see small chapels, inexpensive, modest, humble, which were Methodist chapels, which attracted literally scores of people to the church in the 19th century and even more in the 20th century, up until about 20 years ago.
And in East Anglia.
Sorry?
And in East Anglia.
Well, I didn't mention East Anglia.
No, but there's a lot of Methodists.
Oh, yeah, there were. Nevertheless, the strongest, there are specific bits of East Anglia. Don't find many in Cambridgeshire, find a lot in the other parts of it. But let me carry on for a minute and then do come back. So what one then got out of that was the development of patchy bits of pro-liberal sentiment in the country as a whole. Next thing that happens is that you get the emergence of not only the Liberal Democrats, who at least called on an old tradition of liberalism, you also get two completely new parties. New, but also, in the case of one of them, very old. I mentioned UKIP, which is essentially a nationalist party. It's a party of nationalist English men and women. And the striking thing about UKIP is that it does have, despite it being new, relatively new, it harks back a lot to what I said before about the attitude towards trade and opening the borders and all the rest of it, which we found right back with the Conservatives in the 19th century. The other thing that's striking about UKIP is that it's essentially a party which has been created around a huge cause, and that is essentially the cause of recreating English nationalism and making sure that England doesn't become part of a larger multinational centre, in this case the European Union, but you could imagine in other cases it might be somebody else. So UKIP has developed very fast. It's grown a lot. It has three characteristics. One is what I've just said, the things it believes in. The second thing, which is quite important to say, is that it's actually a very old party. The average age of UKIP voters is much higher than the average age of either Green voters or Lib Dem voters or even Conservative and Liberal voters. And it tends to be a party which is built around a huge attraction to people in love with the past. That's one of the reasons why where UKIP flourishes tends to be in rather old towns like Margate or Hastings or Clacton, towns which have got a lot of links back to the Victorian age, which were essentially the great holiday places to which the Victorians went. I know what I'm talking about. I was a Liberal, I was a Labour candidate in Clacton many, many years ago, and I always remember that the barriers around Frinton, the poshest part of Clacton, went down when I tried to hold a meeting there, and I was told I wasn't welcome. That's rather rare in Britain, but it was certainly true about Clacton 35, 40 years ago. The other new party, which is much more a party of now, doesn't look backwards but looks entirely forwards, is of course the Greens. The Greens, of course, are committed to the concept, above all things, of cleaning up the environment, of dealing with the threat of climate change, of making sure that the laws and regulations in the UK reflect the passion for greenness, for non-environmental damage. And they have grown very fast in very few places, but in those few places, they're strong. Brighton is the typical example. Obviously, Brighton has got a Green member, Caroline Lucas, who's the one Green member of the House of Commons. But she's got an appeal which goes well beyond being one member, and she has begun to attract quite a lot of people to her cause. What that's done is to suddenly, quite dramatically, and it came to a head at the last election, to move us from being an almost automatically traditional two-party country. I'll pause for a minute. What's the other two-party country that leaps to your mind?
US.
Master's not allowed to
ask. US.
Who else? Master's got to be silent until the question's asked. Any other country? Big democracy? Two parties dominated? No, France had many parties. Yes, that's quite right. Who said that? A gold star to that man. The USA. Almost nobody has ever made any serious inroads since the Civil War on the Republican-Democrat control, effectively, of the US democracy at the federal level. You can get little individual state parties. You get that in what other country in Europe? No, never mind. I'm being too hard on you.
Germany.
Anyone? No,
Germany.
You can say.
Germany.
Different, though, than I'm talking about. You're quite right, but it's slightly different because that's not the development of new parties. That's an old federal system, Spain. As you know. I was thinking of Spain. In Spain, the emergence, for example, of the Basque people and the Catalans is much more like what's happened to in the case of somewhere like UKIP. It's a challenge to the existing system from one part of a country rather than from one party in a country. Do you get the distinction? Because it's a distinction that revolves around the sense of nationalism. And what's quite striking about the new structure, even of British parties, is that for the first time since the 18th century, several of them are nationalist parties rather than social class parties. Nationalist parties? Name some. In Britain, now.
SNP.
You're not allowed it. SNP. Well, the mouse answers all the questions right. He should be on the quiz programme. The SNP, the Scottish National Party, which today has 95% of all seats in Scotland, 95%, is a nationalist party. Its aim is an independent Scotland. That's where the objective lies. And its commitments are to build that one way or another. May not happen tomorrow, but the SNP is completely unwilling to accept the rejection in last year's referendum of the concept of an independent Scotland. They don't accept it at all, and they are probably waiting their time to try again, which isn't quite yet, but will be quite soon. It isn't the only nationalist party. What else? Other nationalist parties? No, Master? Sorry, somebody? Sorry? Plaid Cymru, yeah, a Welsh Nationalist Party, with nothing like the same passion as the Scots Nationalist Party, but nevertheless, as the gentleman rightly says, it is a party which is committed to saving the Welsh language, is committed to greater degrees of devolution, and so forth. So it's something of a national party. I won't go through all the others, the raving loony party and several more, which are all tiny and don't have a single member of Parliament. But several of them are, there's a Cornish party, for example, a national Cornish party, but you didn't know about that. So as you travel the country, there are little microcosms of independence, sometimes just a county, sometimes several counties, and they are so far not very successful. They haven't attracted a lot of support, with a single exception, a massive exception, of the Scottish National Party. Let's now look at the election. The factors in the election that really matter in the way it came out, the 2015 election, are not really summed up by just looking at political parties. There are much deeper things flowing through the political system. Let me mention just a few of them. To my mind, almost certainly the most important one is that we have a voting electoral system which is totally related to the concept that Britain will always have a two-party system and only two parties that really matter. I'll give you an example. If we had, like Germany, or like France, a proportional voting system, which means that you start by looking at the share of the electorate that voted for a party. Last election, 31% of the public voted for Labour, 35% ultimately voted Conservative. The other parties were all bundled together, and the other quarter didn't count in those two figures. But those two figures is where you start with a proportional system. That tells you what proportion of the public supports what party. And you drop a lot off. They're tiny, they don't matter. The second thing to say about the proportional representation system is that because it starts by looking at the share of the national electorate that votes and who they vote for, it overrides very strongly regional preferences that at the present time in this country can carry the day. An example. I've already mentioned Scotland. 50% of the Scots voted for the SNP, the Scottish National Party, but they got 95% of the seats. 4 million people voted for UKIP and the Greens. 4 million. That's 1 in 10 of the British electorate. They got two seats. Two seats. Not even half of 1% of the seats in the House of Commons. In the case of the Labour Party, they fell about 40 MPs short of what they would have got in a proportional system. In the case of my own party, Liberal Democrats, we ended up with 8 seats we should have had on a proportional system 26, which would have still left the Liberal Democrats as the third largest party in the House of Commons. Now think for just a moment what that would mean if we were used to the idea of coalition in Britain. We would almost certainly have coalitions always. And on 2015, we would have ended up with we'd have had to have a coalition, because the Conservative 35% would not have outweighed the Labour 31% plus the Liberal Democrat 8% plus the UKIP 12%. No way. There would have been no majority for the Conservatives. So we ended up with a Conservative majority, a small one, 12, a paper-thin one, if you like. But nevertheless, it isn't what the British public voted for. The British public voted not to have Conservatives, but they didn't quite make their minds up about what they wanted instead. Now let's look for a moment at some of the other features. That's one important, the most important one. And I think I would probably say in my own context that the British electoral system is now so distorting. And just bear in mind for a moment, you should have had, if you were UKIP, for example, you should have had 20 members of Parliament, or more like 40, and you ended up with just one. If you were the Greens, you should have had 20 members of Parliament, you had just one. So it is a system that now, frankly, screws up the democratic choice of the British public. It was a very fair system when there were only two parties that mattered. Once you get seven, as we have today, of whom five actually have got members of Parliament of some kind or another in the House of Commons, the system becomes, frankly, a source of cynicism, of dissent, of anger, and I think we're going to get a lot of trouble from it. And in my view, the very first issue that we'll have to address in the period after the election is whether we can really live with an electoral system which is so utterly distorting of the wishes of the people. Second difference, which matters. The second difference which does matter was that for the first time in a British election, we found very large sums of money involved in the election itself. That's rare. It's rare for two reasons. I should add just for a moment that in the United States, when you look at a presidential election, you look at the expenditure of up to $8 billion. $8 billion. Huge sums of money. Ever since the era of Obama and since that time, the amounts of money being spent in American elections are frankly so huge. One has to say, sadly, that the country increasingly is not a democracy, but a plutocracy. It's a tough thing to say. Not at the state level. In state legislatures, that's not so important. But once you get to the federal level, then the huge sums of money that people like the Koch brothers put into elections, counting up in the billions, buys the election. And for me, who's somebody who loves the United States, I find it tragic that we're now looking at a democracy which is essentially for sale. I've always fought the idea that we would allow that to happen in Britain, and two things have stood in the way. One was the regulations on how much you can spend, which in this country have been extremely strict. An example, I fought in my own lifetime 11 general elections, won half, lost half, third one being a tie. I never spent in any election, ever, including all the donations that were given to me, more than £20,000, not in any, right up until I stopped standing for an election in 1987. That was the rules. What they said, and they were very effective, if you go over the limited amount you're allowed to spend in the course of a general election campaign, which normally used to last about 5 weeks, your candidate opponent from another party can challenge you, and if he can prove or she can prove that you've actually overspent, the whole election falls, it's destroyed, doesn't go to court, just stops, and you start all over again with a by-election. And that's meant that on the whole, not always in local government, both Scotland and London have got patchy records, but in parliamentary, national government, this country is peculiarly incorrupt compared to most other countries, not because it's wonderful, but because it's got very good regulations and rules. What's happened now is something which I don't think people from my own party, who supported the idea, for one moment thought through. And in this speech, I should be as frank as you like about everybody. That was the idea of a fixed-term election. Now, in some ways, it's a good idea. A fixed-term election means that a parliament lasts for 5 years. it can't last for longer, so you can't have your big man bossing the whole country and becoming a dictator. But equally, you can't have an election before the 5 years are up. I suppose you could have a vote of confidence and the government would then have to fall, but it's quite difficult to do. There's no natural time at which a parliament ends under 5 years. But what it meant, and what most people didn't realise it meant, was that you couldn't stop rich parties, and that primarily means, with respect, the Conservative Party, pouring money in before the campaign was officially announced. And the campaign is only officially announced 3 months before the election date, the end of the 5 years. And even then, it's broken into two parts. The first 6 weeks are fairly generous. The final 6 weeks are as tight as the old system was. But think about it for a moment. What it means is that a rich party can plough money into hiring canvassers, leaflet deliverers, newspaper writers, etc., a year before an election, and the regulations only catch up with them 3 months before the election day. I saw that for myself in this last election, in places which were unexpectedly, because obviously I saw more of Liberal Democrats than anybody else, but places that were thought to be completely solid for a Liberal Democrat MP. Best known would have been Vince Cable in Twickenham, but Edward Davey in Surbiton, the very popular Steve Webb down in Somerset. These men, who were all outstanding, they weren't all, of course, but this particular group were of remarkable talent and quality and very much liked by the public, all lost their seats because they couldn't plough that kind of money in, and up until this election it wouldn't have made any difference because they would have run straight into regulations. So it's a serious change, a major change, and I shall certainly work to get my party to argue that we've got to move back, not out of fixed term elections, but imposing regulations a year before and not just a couple of months before, which is exactly what happened. So in some places, some constituencies, for example, the canvassers, the people who delivered leaflets, the people that ran home with from the polls to say how many people had voted, the people who knocked up the voters who hadn't voted to tell them to vote, were all paid for. Not by us, we hadn't got the money, but mainly by the Conservative Party, sometimes by the Labour Party. And in some cases, people like our whole trade union, a union like Unite, which is a very powerful union, could certainly pour into a constituency like Rotherham and be everywhere for a couple of days, changing the attitude of the public. Number three, the other great safeguard of democracy in Britain is the BBC, because nobody, as you probably know, and any of you who are American will find this extraordinary, no political advertising is allowed in Britain on television or radio at all from the day the election is announced. It can only be the part of that time that the BBC gives to politics that is carefully worked out according to the way in which the last election happened. So you might get a third of the time, a quarter of the time, but it will reflect public attitudes at the beginning of the previous parliament. And nowadays what that tends to mean is that the Conservative and Labour parties get equal numbers, equal amounts of television and radio time, but even the small parties get some kind of broadcast coverage. And it's very interesting, one of the things that shocked my students in the United States was that back in 1989 and 1990, the Communist Party got its broadcast free, and it got its short television programme free, although there were only one, at that time, only one Member of Parliament who was communist. So that means that you again have a much fairer, much more level playing field, if you like, than you would do or could do if things develop in the way that I've been talking about. A last example, and that was, of course, that for a long time, no, penultimate, two. One, a great many people, as you know, followed the polls very closely. The polls showed up to the day of the election that Labour and the Conservatives were head-to-head. Each had 35%. The polls hardly moved at all. They stayed exactly where they were for something like 2 months. Why? Well, I picked up one of the most important pollsters in Britain, who is Peter Riddle, who is the head of YouGov. And I chose him because YouGov is considered to be pretty independent. And he's a decent, upright sort of man. He told me that the thing that they couldn't work out, they didn't know why it happened, was that something like a quarter of the electorate, across all parties, must have changed their minds in the polling booth itself. In other words, they were right in their estimates, but they were a day behind. Because on the day itself, a very large number of voters decided to run to the Conservatives, having previously been Liberal Democrat, in some cases even Labour, and that made all the difference in the world. I'll tune in a moment, the last thing about one of the reasons why. One of the most effective arguments the Conservatives had was that they were traditionally thought to be good at the economy, good at managing an economy, good at understanding international markets, good at making quite a lot of money, and therefore, presumably good at business. And all of that meant that there, from the very beginning of the election, David Cameron had something like an 18-point lead over Ed Miliband on the key question, which party do you think is best at running the economy? And of course they were helped by the fact that on the whole the poor vote much less than the rich, the young vote much less than the old, and therefore an electorate which was substantially had very substantial proportions of elderly and rich people voted in very large numbers to the party that they thought was the more capable of running the economy. But the other factor nobody had assumed, and that of course was the sudden emergence of the Scottish National Party into prominence with a very outstanding leader, Nicola Sturgeon, who was brilliant at television, popular, relatively young, highly thought of. And she burst on the scene almost immediately and started talking about what England owes Scotland, what Scotland could ask for, what it would expect from a new British Parliament, don't forget British, not Scottish or English, but British, and she made it very clear that her price was going to be very high indeed. That outraged a lot of English people. Not just the idea of so much money going to Scotland, but even more the idea that was put across brilliantly by the Conservatives, that Scotland would be telling a British government of all, Scottish, Welsh, English, Northern Irish, exactly how to operate, what laws to pass, and all the rest of it. And the Conservatives, particularly Mr. Cameron, produced a brilliant picture of a Westminster cowed, bullied, and beaten by a much smaller group of people in Scotland, which has, of course, about 10% of the UK population, which is now 60 million. Scots' population is just under 5 million. So it's a very small part of the whole, it's not even 10%. But it had this amazing capacity to get across what it stood for. And I should add to that, what it stood for was not Scotland as we know it. It was a dream of Scotland, a wonderful picture of Scotland, a Scotland that was art-loving, land-loving, scenically beautiful, bold, brave, more egalitarian, more fair, more socially just than England has been for a very long time. And that particular picture was extraordinarily powerful. One thing to add, which made me particularly very angry. I had spent 2 weeks in Scotland, I have part of my family lives in Scotland, during the Scottish referendum, because I could see it was going badly wrong. The No campaign was weak, feeble, had far too much of a tendency to lecture the Scots, which they don't like. Well, nobody likes being lectured, not just the Scots, nobody. But the British establishment lectured the Scots, and the Scots hated it. And I could see that the possibility of a Scotland leaving the Union was growing week by week. I went up there in order to find out what was going on and discovered to my amazement that the record of Scottish government, and the SNP wears half the government with a Conservative coalition partner from 2008 to 2012, 3.5 years of government, and you won't believe it, but it's true. They spent less on National Health Service than England does. They had bigger classes in the primary schools than England has. They had less money put into further education and skill training than England does. And on top of the whole thing, they then imposed on Scotland, which has only ever had one district where the police are armed, the police were armed through the whole of Scotland, and the Highlands nearly went daft because they didn't like the idea of armed police when they'd never had them and they didn't want them to start. But not a single British politician, left or right, actually ever asked the question, what about the record in Scotland? Because they didn't know it, they hadn't followed it, they hadn't crossed the border and gone north to find out what was really going on. And that's one of the reasons that the election came out in the amazing way that it did. End of part two. Part three is much shorter, you'll be glad to know, because you're probably being very good to hang on so much, but you'll probably be slowly perishing. So let's jump to the future. As I already said, we've inherited a ludicrously unfair voting system. Now, it wasn't unfair in the past. This is a new thing. It wasn't altogether accurate, but it was broadly reflected the opinion of the British people. We've seen in 2015 it no longer does that. It completely failed to get the picture. And it's not a system that adapts to four or five parties. It's entirely made for two. It's like trying to marry five people. It just doesn't work very well. So what's now happened is this is going to be a challenge for the House of Commons. Will they have the vision and the wisdom to realise that they can't hang on to an outdated system just because it benefits their party? And there's no doubt. First past the post benefits the Conservative Party and the Labour Party as against the smaller parties. It sacrifices the smaller parties to the pressure to have a very large majority or a stable single government one way or another. That's the first question. The second question is, how do we actually reform Parliament itself? And I'm going to throw up to you a few very short new ideas. You're very welcome to kick them around as much as you like. I think Britain will only survive as the United Kingdom if it moves towards a federal structure. What that means is that the Scottish Parliament, the Welsh Parliament, the Northern Irish Parliament will all run their own domestic affairs. They'll be devolved from Westminster to them. So on things like health, housing, land planning, the usual obvious group of domestic concerns, the countries concerned, the sub-countries, and you, I think, mentioned Germany, very good example of Germany, where the federal power has power over defence, power over major economic issues and so forth, but not power over individual things like health and education and so on. I think we have to move the same way. And I think we have to have a federal parliament in Britain. But I would add one more revolutionary attitude. I think the House of Lords should be changed into a federal Senate. In other words, the House of Lords should become the place where scrutiny of major legislation, scrutiny of such things as adequate consultation with the people, with their interests, with NGOs and so on, becomes the responsibility of the House of Lords. It becomes the place that has to look after the separate countries to make sure that they're equally fairly treated in the United Kingdom as a whole. My personal view is that that would be make it much easier to ensure that the United Kingdom remains a single federal country like Germany has done, even with the introduction of East Germany. It's still a country which is federal and democratic, and that wasn't an easy thing to do. So my second proposal would be, first one being change the voting system, the second one would be make sure that you have a federal House of Lords as the coping stone over a federal United Kingdom. Thirdly, we have to fight like hell, and here I am going to be political for a minute. I've seen the awful headlines this morning in the Telegraph, if you want to look it up, which says that the government is proposing that Ofcom, the Office of Communications, should become the new oversight of the BBC. That bluntly would be an absolute disaster, because it means that a government body becomes the oversight of the BBC, which is famous throughout the world as the most single-minded, independent, open, free, transparent broadcasting system that there is. And as I've already told you, the gateway to a free and genuinely democratic British political system, because you can't advertise by paying money. You have to get the permission and the agreement of the BBC. I'm about to conclude finally with this. On top of all that, the issues that now confront us are so huge, so multinational, that we've got to try to develop out of our own reform of our own democracy a major way of reforming the democracy of the region to which we belong, the European Union. And of course beyond that, when I talk about multinational, where judges are well ahead of the whole of the rest of us, because things like the International Criminal Court, which are hellishly hard to hold on to, as the recent conflict in South Africa has just shown, where they refuse to allow the challenging of the undoubtedly genocidal Prime Minister of South Sudan. That's got to be part of the coping stone of a liberal world. I mean a liberal world, I don't mean politically, I mean a liberal-minded world. But one step back, the big issues that confront us are climate change, to which there is no national solution. You can sit there, you can be Indian or Chinese or British or whatever, but there's no national solution. Because if you come up with a solution and somebody else doesn't bother with it, forget it. The world will warm. The world will get up to 2 degrees more, and we'll all die within the century. No doubt about it at all. If you don't want proof, I'll give you my source, because he's unimpeachable. My source is the chairman of the Royal Society. And without any doubt, he and the Royal Society, the premier scientific body in England, know perfectly well that 2 degrees is as much as we can possibly manage between now and the end of the century. If you want to look it up, there's a marvellous book that he wrote. I'll tell you what it's called. I'm trying to remember his name rather desperately. I will in a minute. It's called The Next Century? And the argument, the message of the book is there won't be a next century unless we take all this much more seriously than we've taken it up to now. There'll be half another century. Oh yes, we'll get to 2020, 40, 50, but according to him, not much more. His name is Lord Stern. The book is available. It's a marvellous book, a wonderful search through the whole history and climate change, and it makes no bones at all about the fact that we are much nearer the end than we think we are. The second huge issue that confronts us, on top of that, is the growing number of illnesses which are now antibiotic resistant. The most recent example has been in South Korea, as you may have seen, and yet we still are very poor at actually taking the steps that are needed to stop that raging through our society the way the Spanish flu raged through the world after the First World War. And the third and final one that I want to mention to you, and in some ways I think it may be one of the most serious of all, is what we face with the immigration problem. Now again, let me be completely blunt in finishing this lecture. It is no good at all imagining that a combination of rescuing people out of the graveyard called the Mediterranean and then sending them back whence they came will solve the problem. It won't even begin to. Last year I went to Eritrea. Anybody here from Eritrea? It's like Dante's Inferno. It's a country of hell. Everybody is living in ruins. Everything that stood was wrecked in the civil war that it had with Ethiopia. Nothing's left. Families live desperately on the edge of broken concrete, broken bricks. They don't have any food to eat. The country has almost nothing in the way of exports, because who wants to buy straw dolls, which is about all that they make, and baskets. The government is a totally ruthless dictatorship. And of course, as usual, the great man has a very large palace that he lives in, and a very expensive one. If you're an Eritrean person, a human being, not a government leader or a king, you have absolutely nothing to live for. And so it's easier to put all you've got and put it together and take a cockle shell boat and try to get to Italy or Greece, because there's nothing in Eritrea, nothing to keep you, nothing. Well, that's what it's going to be like in about a third of the world. So unless we actually pluck up our courage and guts and think in the same terms that after the Second World War the West did, something called the Marshall Plan, which rescued Europe within 3 years of the war leaving it in ruin, which rescued Germany and rescued Italy and rescued France, and the rest of us paid, and it was infinitely worth it, because 10 years down the track Europe was up and prospering again. Unless we're prepared to do that, to exploit things like the huge solar power potential of the Sahara, which is sitting there waiting for that to happen, not fossil fuel dug up and stuck into our garages, but a serious attempt to try to replace fossil fuel with solar power, which the Sahara is made for, we will actually see more and more and more people flinging themselves in desperate attempt to get to our countries, and we'll refuse them, and then they'll go another way, and ultimately drown somewhere. Sorry to end so gloomily, but that's the scale of the political challenges that actually confront us. Thanks for listening.